Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, we'll talk about some news in the world of Houston restaurants, as well as our meal at a Houston restaurant you may want to try. To do that, I am joined by my co-host this week. She is a former commercial real estate developer and a marketing expert. Monica Dano, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I think we've determined it's been a couple weeks since I've been on, maybe a couple months.
Yeah, this is your first, other than the date night draft, this is your first appearance as a co-host in 2026.
That's right. I apologize.
You're a busy lady. You're hard to book.
It's more my fault than yours.
I appreciate you acknowledging that. All right. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one, sad news. The Raven Grill is closing after 28 years in Boulevard Oaks. Now, you still have it's closing at the end of the month, so time is running out. But Monica, I mean, this is not like, I'm not gonna pretend that this is like the most culturally significant restaurant in the history of Houston, but anytime a place has been around for 20, 25, almost 30 years, I think it's worth noting because it's probably been 10 years in round numbers since my last meal at the Raven Grill. Yeah. If I'm being perfectly honest, it was a favorite of the parents of an ex of mine. And so when we split up, I backed out like that.
You lost it in the breakup.
I lost it in the breakup. So
yeah,
it's been a long time, but this was one of those like kind of quiet under the radar places where you could have like a nice dinner. Prices were reasonable. The atmosphere was always nice. They were known for their chicken fried steak back in the day. And there's just not that much Southwestern cuisine left anymore. You know, this was a movement that kind of flourished in the 80s into the 90s. And like the, you know, the Ruggles Grill is, you know, Ruggles Grill became Ruggles Black. It's not really the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, Cafe Annie became the Annie Cafe. They still have some of that stuff like the crab enchiladas and the tortilla soup, but it's not really the same thing. So Raven Grill is part of this bygone era of Houston restaurants. And so I just wondered if you had any Raven Grill memories to share.
You know, I probably haven't been to the Raven Grill in even longer than you. I lived in the Museum District about 15 years ago, and that's probably more when I frequented that. I went to on a first date there once. That's probably my biggest memory there. It did not last. But, you know, I think as a child growing up in Houston, kind of in the near Northwest, kind of North Side Heights, Oak Forest area, the Museum District and Bissonnette always kind of seemed like this very far off thing, you know, and like Montrose was the furthest south we would go, you know. So I think, you know, discovering it as an adult, as I was living in the Museum District, was a little bit different than, you know, growing up going there as a child or, you know, parents going there. I don't think my parents have ever been there. But, you know, I think you're right in that, you know, you mentioned this in the article on Culture Map when you kind of talked about the closing, but, you know, these neighborhood restaurants like Polly's that we're seeing, you know, really closing, kind of coming to an end of, I would put Raven Grill kind of in that neighborhood category, probably a staple of people that lived within a 2 to 3 mile radius. Those are the people that are kind of hurt for this the most, right? I don't think that anyone outside of that area, this is their favorite restaurant, right? They're you know, going to be extremely excited that this is closing. So not surprising, but, you know, obviously laudable anytime a restaurant is sticking around for that long. They're clearly doing something right, even if it's not groundbreaking cuisine culturally in Houston. The fact that they got probably in a good location, in a good kind of demographic, you know, had some good food. Cheers to them for lasting as long. And they've got, you know, the Picnic spinoff, which I think made a leap to Austin at one point too. So they've got, you know, it to kind of live on under that brand.
Yeah, I think Picnic's going to live on, I guess, probably through the end of its lease, whenever that comes. It sounds like, from the nature of the Facebook post that they shared about the closing, that the property is up for redevelopment, which kind of makes sense given all of the activity in the Museum District. You know, if you owned a little strip center, you might want to fancy it up a little bit in light of all the high rise and stuff that have been built there in the last 30 years. Whatever they're calling the Ashby High Rise, that new building finally opened, and it's
right there on
Bissonnette. It's
Bissonnette. And, you know, I was just thinking, like, Bissonnette's been pretty unchanged in the past 30 years, aside from the Ashby High Rise. and, you know, all the signs about the Ashby high rise over the past, you know, 6 to 7 years that have littered that street. It's kind of been untouched in that developmental way. So, and I think that's very charming about that part of town. So hopefully we won't see too much change, at least in the architectural features of some of those smaller strip centers with some cute little neighborhood restaurants. But yeah, you know, part of town that I don't frequent that often, but when I do, it's, you know, it's kind of regal, right? It's the museum district. And I appreciate that about those restaurants.
Right. I mean, we don't talk about the museum district very much because there aren't that many restaurants to talk about. Right. That's even more true for kind of West U and Boulevard Oaks and all that. Cause there isn't, right. We talk about Rice Village. We talk about Montrose, right? Like if you live in Boulevard Oaks, it's easy enough to cross 59 and go to, you know, Nano's, Nobi's, Toasted Coconut, Pit Room, sure. Candente, all of those places. So, you know, Raven Grill, I mean, I remember many, many years ago running into my 10th grade English teacher there. And, you know, that makes sense, right? That the,
right.
the
that tracks.
You know, the Lord Byron obsessed private school English teacher would be hanging at the Raven time. Grill. That yeah. seems that makes sense.
Yeah.
So again, I don't think this is going to cause a lot of consternation. I mean, it was well read as all closing stories are, but I just did want to acknowledge that time is up for the Raven Grill is flying away, I guess is yeah. the short version. All right. Let's move on to topic number two. This is kind of a fun one. I think, United has partnered with Chef's Table, the Netflix documentary series, to recruit chefs from 10 United cities to create premium menus for its Polaris business class. In Houston, they recruited Justin Yu, who is a James Beard Award winner, a Food & Wine Best New Chef. His restaurant, Theodore Rex, holds a Bib Gourmand designation in the Michelin Guide, and regulars on this podcast know him as our annual visitor who recaps Seasons of the Bear with me.
Yeah.
So, Monica, I mean, again, like the Polaris business class is a premium offering for very frequent travelers. So I don't know how many of us will actually get to fly United and experience this meal that Justin is creating. They can't say yet, or they're not saying yet what the dishes are. It's going to be an appetizer, a salad, and an entree. And it's going to use a lot of local ingredients. And Justin said it's going to have a bit of an Asian influence, which makes sense because of Houston is Houston. And also he's Chinese American. So anyway, I say all that to say to you, what do you think about this? Were you surprised that Justin, of all people, is the chef representing Houston?
I'm not. I'm excited about this. You know, Justin's been cooking food for the United Lounge for years, right? I'm a frequent traveler, frequent United
Lounge. Yeah, the Centurion Lounge, right? The Amex Lounge.
Yeah. Well, United. Well, is it? Oh yeah, I guess it is. I guess you're right. It is Centurion. I go to both. Sorry.
Oh, there you go.
So seeing his food on a placard, his name kind of on a placard in the club, right? I think was cool. I've seen it in other cities. I think Denver one time there was, you know, Justin's name was on that because you're right. So it's Centurion. So I think that's smart in that vein. I think also, you know, I like having other chefs from Houston getting some recognition. We love and adore Chris Shepherd, friend of the show, but seems to kind of get tagged for a lot of these opportunities. I like that, you know, Justin has, you know, something to offer as well. And hopefully, you know, travelers who are experiencing this get to know him and his restaurants through that lounge experience. I mean, through the Polaris experience for business class.
No, I'm thrilled for Justin. It's a very cool opportunity for him. I will say, and he described himself as an unexpected choice for an opportunity like this. And I, you know, and in some sense, I agree a little bit, only because if you look at like kind of the new school, like the new critical darlings or national darlings in the food space in Houston, it's like, oh, it's Emmanuel Chavez, it's Nick and Stephanie from Casa Emma, it's Thomas Billy, it's Chef G from Street to Kitchen. I mean, all of them are kind of more recent, like James Beard, either nominees or winners. You know, they're all of them are also in the Michelin Guide. And so, you know, if I were just guessing blind, like who are they going to pick? It would have been one of them. But I'm thrilled for Justin. And I know that he's got like a very defined culinary perspective and a real sense, I think, of what's going to be good when you're, when we were talking, he said 10,000 feet in the air, but it, you know, more like 25 or 30,000 feet in the air.
Yeah.
that, like, what will be comforting? What will be, what will make the hassles of traveling slightly less inconvenient or make you feel a little better about being on a plane? So I'm excited for Justin. I'm excited for this partnership, and I look forward to seeing what the food is. It's going to roll out in August. So I think we'll see more specifics about this sometime between now and then.
Well, we're going to have to hit up United and see if we can, you know, get on a flight. We need to check it out.
Person. Or at least arrange a taste. Like they might do an on-ground tasting, right? They may not give us Polaris class seats to.
We could ask
in New York or whatever. We can certainly ask. Yes, you're right. We for strictly for research purposes, you
of
know,
course,
for
of work. Course.
All right, and then again, I don't want to get too caught up in the weeds on this, but the Swift Building, a new development near MKT in the Heights from Radome Capital and Triton Partners, has announced their next two tenants. It will be Van Leeuwen, the Brooklyn-based ice cream shop, and Limu, the premium juice bar that's got a location in the Montrose Collective and also in Radome's project near Memorial City Mall. They're joining previously announced tenants Escalante and Merit Coffee from San Antonio. Monica, you've developed a bunch of properties in the Heights and helped put packages of different tenants together in surrounding neighborhoods. What do you think of this lineup for the Swift Building?
You know, I was developing real estate when Steve kind of closed on this property and started the MKT development, which Swift is a part of. And I remember the leasing agent at the time kind of gave me a tour before anything was built. And they were very excited about the Swift Building back then. This was probably 6 or 7 years ago, maybe even longer. And, you know, it's been cool to see this come to light. I think there was a lot of skepticism about this project, not just the Swift Building, but MKT in general, because of just kind of access. It's a little hard to get to. It's backs up to the neighborhood, kind of have to U-turn if you're coming from the north. But I've been pleasantly surprised with how both MKT and this building's, you know, leasing has come together. You know, I think that, you know, historically, these types of kind of reuse projects, you know, you're putting in kind of mom and pops, maybe they're not, you know, kind of certain, and some larger national brands want to be in a bright new, you know, shiny building. But I like that Steve has done a really good job of merchandising that area with a little bit of local and a little bit of kind of out of state brands coming into Houston. So I know I've got personally have friends that office over there at the MKT office space, and they're very excited about this building, getting some tenants in. So I think it's coming along nicely. I think, you know, just like any development center, some stay, some don't, you know, they kind of figure out who's right for the center. So there's been some tenants in and out of MKT, but that's just normal. But no, I like this mix. I think that's probably the success of MKT as a retail center definitely has impacted the kinds of tenants they've been able to sign for this building.
Right. I think that's well said. And I think, you know, just to emphasize your point, MKT, when they were sort of explaining it, seemed like an unlikely destination for a major mixed use development because it's down, right? Like you see it as you're on Shepherd Drive and you go over that railroad crossing or the hike and bike trail. So you have to kind of, you have to know that it's there a little bit to detour off of it. But we should say this has not been a problem. I mean, you know, every time I have to go there, you know, it's always like circle twice to find parking. You know, DeGama obviously has done very well and spot in the Michelin Guide last year. Homestead, the breakfast place, Mala's there, Honey Child Sweet Creams is there, some of the best ice cream in Houston, and also national brand Sweet Green is there. Ben Berg put Buttermilk Baby there. Like it's done very well. And so I think you're right. I think the success of MKT has expanded the possibility for what the Swift Building could be, just because it's like, okay, well, there's already this very successful development next door. And we can take advantage of that.
And that's, you know, that's by design, right? A lot of these larger, you know, urban projects are phased out. Let's see how this goes. We're really kind of counting on the success and the underwriting, right? Of what's setting the tone for rents, right? I mean, in a big way, MKT really had a large impact on rents, retail rents in the Heights area. and, you know, I would say a positive impact for developers, maybe a negative impact for operators, because it did rise, you know, a lot of those, you know, retail rent spaces for what, you know, a national brand could come in and do retail wise in that Heights pocket.
Yeah. And I will say, you can always tell a Redome development because it always has ice cream. MKT has Honeychild.
Yeah.
Heights Mercantile has Cloud 10. Van Leeuwen at Montrose Collective, and now also at the Swift Building. I don't necessarily understand the logic of
it's a low parking user. So ice cream is permitted as a to-go spot, so it needs less parking for total because people aren't there a long time. That's the argument. It's a to-go spot. So a lot of bigger developments are going to put in some sort of a to-go parking to get those parking counts down needed. So obviously, maybe Steve Roof really likes ice cream too.
Yeah, maybe he just really likes ice cream. I don't, you know, and he's ice cream agnostic. It's, you know, different,
sure,
different, yeah, ice cream shops and different maybe developments. One of these days, we'll have to have Steve on the show to talk about, sure, you know, the logic, yeah, of ice cream in every development. All right. Monica, I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurant of the week. Stick around. Monica, for our restaurant of the week, I want to talk to you about Long Weekend. This is what I am describing as a kind of Texas Ranch-inspired restaurant and bar in the former King's Beer House space up in kind of on the border of Lazy Brook Timber Grove and Shady Acres, which you cannot call that area the Heights, because the people who live in the Heights will get very mad at you and swear that is not the Heights. So we would never call that the Heights.
Yeah.
Heights adjacent, maybe, but not actually the Heights. All right. I want to talk about this restaurant as like the dining experience that we had, and then we can kind of wade into some of this controversial stuff about,
sure,
the playground and how people are reacting to the playground.
What? It's a controversy? What's happening?
You know, who knows? Who knows? Who knows how controversial it actually is, or if there's just like three pissed off neighbors. I'm never quite sure how that works out. All right.
I can't log on to Facebook within the last week without seeing Long Weekend pop up. But yeah, let's get into our experience and then let's get into that.
Right. So, all right. So, you know, obviously Andrew Aldis, who is a commercial real estate developer and also is a partner in Wild, the kind of THC friendly coffee shop that just closed its Montrose location. I'm still going strong in the Heights. This is the person behind this. And it's inspired by his family's ranch in West Texas. So what did you think of kind of what were your first impressions as you walked in and kind of took in the design of Long Weekend?
Yeah, I had actually popped in before you and I went, I think opening week, just to kind of do a walkthrough. This is kind of my wheelhouse area, right? Our little league is blocks away. I live five minutes away. A lot of buzz, right, about this place before it opened. So I did pop over the week that it opened just for a quick, you know, flyby, sat at the bar, had a drink, and then left. So you know, when you and I are there, not much different, right? Similar crowd. I think my first thought is, wow, this is massive, you know, and I'd been to King's Beer House before. I'd been to the Egg House, and I knew they had taken the Egg House over to do kind of breakfast morning concept. But walking through the space, I mean, because of some side patios and a huge back patio, it just felt massive. It felt like a very large scale restaurant, you know, open air and to a lot of degrees, you know, that west and north side of the buildings almost entirely could open up with, and it was nice weather, right, when we were there. So it made it feel much larger, I think, too, because, you know, those doors and windows were open and you could see kind of all the way back to the back fence. So first glance is, you know, like you said, Western Ranch, you know, aesthetic, nailed it, right? I mean, there's cow hides on the wall, there's custom cowboy art, there's, you know, longhorns everywhere you look. I think they did a really good job with that sort of kind of West Texas ranch feel.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. And I think, you know, they've really leaned into it with like small details, right? Like you walk in and there's, you know, like a kind of an Instagram photo op thing with like a couple of saddles, yeah, you know, for kids to sit on. You know, there's a cowhide painting of two riders on the trail. And you know, when we were there, Andrew gave us a tour and was kind of showing us around and said, yeah, this is me and my dad on the trail. Like that's what inspired this yeah. look. And, you know, I do think like it's a very, you know, it's a comprehensive renovation. It's very, you know, it feels themed, like it feels cohesive without being kitschy.
Pokey. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because I think if you, you know, like the, not to pick on one, but like, you know, Saltcrest Steakhouse is kind of the,
yeah,
the most obvious, like Texas themed kind of
sure.
restaurant. And that's, you know, it's a chain and it's got its own kind of aesthetic, but that's more kitschy.
Yeah. I would call this more like modern cowboy, right? A lot of glass in the restaurant, a lot of wood. It didn't feel kitschy. And I should mention, you know, the Pecos Grill, for those of us raised in that area over the past, you know, 40 to 50 years, was a very popular kind of Texas themed. It was Texas Tumbleweed. After that, it was the Pecos Grill. And we used to go there, steak dinners. You know, people were two-stepping, there was live music. So, you know, I think that was a really cool place for them to put that. I know it was a second generation space that they kind of stumbled upon, but those of us from the neighborhood, you know, are reminiscent about Texas Tumbleweed and, you know, Pecos Grill, which was in that center as well. So very similar, but, you know, 80s and 90s.
All right. And then let's talk about the menu. I mean, again, Herman Mascara, who worked at Wild for a while until, you know, the Montrose location closed and was always attached to this project. You know, I was sort of reminiscing at dinner. I mean, I've known Herman across several restaurants. When I met him, he was at La Column d'Or. He was at Roots Bistro in Montrose back in the day. He spent some time at Brazil. You know, he's a talented guy. And it, you know, it's interesting to see like so much meat on the menu, because I remember when he personally, you know, there was a period of time when he was a vegetarian and yeah. was like very much like pushing vegetarian kind of meals. And now he's making chicken fried steak and, you know, grilled pork belly and all these other things on the long weekend menu. But, I don't know. What did you think about the food that we tried?
You know, and I told you this when we were there, I don't know why, I didn't have super high hopes for the actual food. I think everything I had heard leading up to our meal, because I didn't eat the first time I went, was about kind of the operation and the restaurant. So I had a preconceived notion that they were so focused on the family aspect that the food was going to be secondary. But, you know, I was wrong, and I really enjoyed the food. I know you and I, you know, tend to be picky. You pickier than me probably, but, you know, I was really impressed. I mean, we probably had total 12 dishes or so.
Yeah. I mean, they buried us.
I mean, maybe one or two of those maybe had some misses for us. But other than that, you know, I was really impressed with, you know, the quality of what they sent out. You know, I think our favorite was the chicken fried Wagyu steak, obviously, was a favorite for me. You know, the appetizers, right? I think being a family friendly restaurant, having lots of appetizers where people are sitting down, and maybe a large family or a couple of multiple families, having a large, pretty good, appetizers out rounded out kind of small plates. Had several of those, you know, potatoes with caviar on top were just insane. So I was really pleasantly surprised with, you know, how well the food was executed.
I was too. I've had some very delicious meals from Herman over the years. I know what he's capable of, but you know, when the restaurant's that big and there were so many people there, you know, you wonder about its ability to execute. And I know that, you know, we were very much a known quantity, and I'm sure they fussed over every plate they sent us, but still the quality of the cook on, you know, you mentioned the chicken fried steak, you know, but I thought I threw him a curveball, you know, give me the rainbow trout, which is served with this like lemon and honey glaze. And the fish was flaky. It was meaty. It was moist. It was a little bit sweet with that honey glaze, and so delicious. And, you know, like, yeah, I expect them to do stuff like the, you know, the burger or the crispy tacos that we had as an appetizer, like, that's the kind of kid-friendly stuff that I expect them to crank out.
Yeah.
But these healthier things or some of these more unusual dishes aren't an afterthought. I think that speaks really well of kind of what they're going for here.
Yeah.
Even if like I, you know, it's a little bit hard to imagine like who's going to order the rainbow trout necessarily, but
yeah.
But I'm glad that it's there. You know, just as I mean, yes, I ate the chicken fried steak, but you know, I don't always want to eat that way. And it was kind of the same thing with the pork belly, right? Like,
we
talk about how, you know, expensive steaks are, and certainly, you know, a 14-ounce strip for $45, a boneless ribeye for $54, or you can get the pork belly and it's $28.
Yeah.
And it's very meaty and it's got that sweet glaze and it's very satisfying. You know, it's just a little rich, right? Like you're only going to eat so much of that before you're just kind of tapped out. But
yeah. And they kind of describe it as like, you know, that kind of food that, you know, you're riding the trail all day, right? And you're coming back and it's what the chef at camp is cooking for the trail riders. And it did feel that way. Very smoky, very heavy, a lot of it, right? They did have salads. They did have, I think, at least one soup. We did not want to fill up on salad. So we had more
there's a beet salad that we did not, and a grilled romaine.
Yeah.
Neither of which we bothered with.
Yeah. Well, and the family friendly offerings too. I think that's always important, you know, and Andrew did, you know, kind of talk with us when he was there about, you know, the owners have kids, right? So they know that when you're going to a restaurant or just not just throwing some fried nuggets on a plate that were frozen before, they really have, you know, featured food that, you know, kids will eat, but that it's made well and it's quality. We did not get a pizza, which there is a beautiful pizza oven there, which I've heard great things about just from friends that have been there. But, you know, I think those kind of things are going to keep families coming back. I had lots of friends there when we were there, and I was kind of going out and bringing them some of our leftovers because we had so much food that they brought us out. But I was kind of checking in with them while I was going out there, like, how's y'all's, and they were having a good experience too. It's almost like two separate restaurants, the outdoors and the indoors, and we can get into that. But I would think that some of those heavier dishes, some of those more adult dishes, there'll be a bigger percentage of those sold inside. And then outside's a lot of appetizers, kid stuff, pizzas, right? So that's what I would kind of expect operationally to see.
Right. I think that's right. And, you know, we didn't like the onion rings. It's a weird thing to complain about. Like we like the entrees, we like the starters, we didn't like the onion rings, but Andrew messaged me that they've already tweaked the recipe, like in response to our feedback.
Oh, and I also wonder, like, how much of that is you and I just had been to Star Rover recently, and those were so good.
Yeah, those onion rings are hard to beat. I cite the ones at Pappas Brothers Steakhouse as maybe the best in Houston. And if you like the thin strings, then Pappas Burger has the best. But he said he messaged me. He said they're beer battered now. They've changed the recipe. So
cool.
Anyway, so yes, we're already making people's lives better even before this episode is released.
Onion at a time.
One onion at a time. All right. Let's talk about the environment, because obviously the whole thing about this restaurant is it has a very large playground in the backyard, the patio, whatever you want to call it. It's like a multi-level play structure with various climbing apparatuses. It's got this whole net that goes into a tree.
Yeah.
Like if I were a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old, I think I'd be very excited to have access to this thing. And that's really kind of what we saw, right? Is that there were basically adults dining in the main dining room. And then the entire outside area was families with young kids. Let's just say roughly like 2 to 8. Because by the time I think a kid is old enough for like kind of serious organized sports, right? Like, you know, 10, 11, 12, like they're too old for this.
Yeah. And I, as the mom of a 10-year-old, subscribe to what you're saying in that. Yes. I think parents of younger kids, I think, are more likely to go to a place with the play structure. You know, older kids, you know, 10, 11, 12, you know, they're either looking at devices or they're just not really interested. And a lot of times, a lot of those places, and I can say this as a parent, you know, there are smaller kids on these play structures. So you don't want your larger kid roughhousing around with small kids because you don't want them to be hurt. So a lot of, you know, younger kids, some older ones too, but I think the majority we saw were, you know, parents with younger kids. And you're right. I mean, the whole back patio, I could not imagine, if you did not have kids with you or have kids in general, why you would sit out there unless it's just a beautiful day. But I do think that that was what we observed: a lot of adults inside, a lot of, you know, families outside.
Right. And, you know, there's a certain amount of chaos that goes with having that many children in one place at the same time, right? Like they're shrieking, they're running, they're playing, which is what you would expect them to do. There's a playground.
Yep.
And of course, we're sitting inside, you know, along the hallway to the bathroom. And so, you know, every, you know, 10 minutes or so, two, three, four kids comes running by our table, either on their way to the bathroom or back from the bathroom. So it's not like if you, like, you know, we sort of joked about it. We're sitting at dinner. It's like, this is not a place you would go for like a romantic date night. Because there's no way to be like completely isolated from the sheer quantity of children. And I like you, I've been on Facebook kind of reading people's reaction to this place. And I've seen a couple of posts from adults who tried to go there without children, and they're upset about the fact that there's children there, to which I say, there's a giant fucking playground at this restaurant. Like, why, why did you think that this was going to be like not full of children? It is designed for families with children.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I, not to pick on somebody or not to name names, but I, you know, Albert Nurek, who's been the head of the Woodlands Area Foodies Facebook group for years and years and knows a lot about restaurants and dining, is like, you know, posted something like, well, we'll never go there until they remove the playground. Albert, they don't want your money. You are not the customer.
Yeah. Right? No, like, and I think it's this eternal argument, especially on the neighborhood food Facebook groups, right? It's the dinks versus the families. You know, it's the double income, no kids foodies, right? Who have lots of, you know, expendable income and like to dine out. And that's definitely a sector. And then you've got the families who are living, you know, waiting until their next meal that they don't have to cook at home and want to go out, right? So this isn't anything we haven't seen before. It's obviously been heightened because it's turned into a legal battle because some residents that kind of back up to the restaurant, their homes, right? Residential lots do back up to this commercial space, which has been a restaurant space for as long as I can remember. But for some reason now, because of the noise, and I think mainly because of the playground, the size of the playground, it's up.
Right. Above. The height of the playground allows children to peer into their backyards. There's a privacy concern.
And they're upset, which I get it. That's an upsetting thing. It's not illegal, right? You bought a residential property.
Right. You bought a residential property next to a commercial development with the restaurant depot that has 18 wheelers coming in and out of it all the time.
Right. Like, right.
It's not a quiet place. It's not, you know, this isn't 30 acres north of Conroe where you can like
obviously,
be away from.
And we live in Houston and there's no zoning. And, you know, I've read them all, right? There's so many posts, and you and I are part of the same group, so we don't have to kind of belabor what all the posts say, but there's people on one side and there's people on the other. And, you know, the bottom line is, look, no one's forcing you to go here. If it's not a place that, I mean, and I made a comment this weekend on one of the posts just to kind of say, look, we're melding two arguments here, right? One is there's a bunch of kids there. I don't want to go there. Great. Don't go there. The other one is, you know, the real estate, the complaints about the residents behind and the kids are peering down, which just to me is wild because your neighbor could build a two-story house and look right down into your house. That's on a commercial property. So, you know, some of the complaints of these residential neighbors just baffle me. You know, a lot of it is, you know, ethically, are they doing a right thing, being a good neighbor, you know, as a restaurant that backs up, you know? Yeah, I guess they could have asked you, but we live in a capitalistic, no zoning city, and they are well within their rights to build within their property, within the sound, you know, ordinances and what they can do. They're permitted, but what they're doing, they're permitted for.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you on this. Like I feel bad for the res, right? Like if I live next door to a property that has been empty for a couple of years at this point, and then all of a sudden there were shrieking children, from 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. every night, like I would be unhappy. I'm sure that I would be unhappy.
Yeah.
And I do, you know, we talked to Andrew about this and he'll be on the podcast next week. And obviously we'll get into this some more in that context, but he's willing to compromise and work with them to erect some bamboo or put up a screen or do something to kind of, you know, give them back some of their privacy in their backyards, I guess. The sound is the sound. I mean, you know, if it's within the limits of the noise ordinance, then, you know, turn your TV up, I guess. Buy noise canceling headphones. I mean, it's not a great solution, I admit, but you know, this place isn't going, you know, these people that think that they can pester the city into finding them or citing them or whatever and harassing them out of business. Like, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, you know, they've obviously invested a lot of money in creating this place. It's obviously been very popular, at least for right now. You know, who knows, maybe in the heat of the summer, it'll slow down a little bit, but
yeah,
you know, for right now with good weather, like people want to go here and it's going to be what it is. And I feel bad for the neighbors, but again, this is life in a city with no zoning. I think you just have to kind of put up with it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as a parent, you know, I did not have my kid dining. It was you and I dining without kids. You have nieces. I did see some kids there that I know. They came up to our table, right? And I think that, you know, a lot of the posts online are, you know, kids exist in the world and, you know, kind of get over it. And I understand, you know, like if you're bringing kids into Blue Dorn, right? And they're running amok and there's no playground there, like that's one thing. But if you're complaining or saying, you know, I'm not going to go there because, you know, there's a bunch of kids running around, then don't go there, right? There's 400
right. It's not right. This is like the other restaurants that are known for having a lot of children around. Mia's Table, you know, Cottonwood, D'Alba.
Yeah,
you know, these spaces exist for families with children. And you know, if you're like me and you don't have kids, like, you know, it will probably be, you know, I can't imagine, you know, when my nieces or nephews come to visit, I could see taking them the long weekend because I think they'd like it, even though they're kind of aging out of the playground, but I think they'd like the food and it's, you know, flexible in that way. Or like if I were, you know, we joked about the date night, right? That if you're a person without kids, but you're dating someone who has kids and you're trying to get to know the kids for whatever reason, like, you know, if you've gotten to that point, this could be a good place to do that.
Yeah. And right? Good food.
Right. You can still get good food and you can still get a nice cocktail or even a bottle of wine. And the kids could kind of play. And so you could kind of have that compromise. But
we should say we were there on a Thursday. I think our reservation was at 7:00. You know, it was really just about an hour of that 7 to 8 PM that, you know, there was kids. And I think like it's a small window, right? During the week when, you know, most kids are getting ready for bed or in bed between the hours of 8 and 9, right? So my suggestion would be go on a weeknight, go a little bit later if you're not wanting to be around that. I'm sure the weekends are crazy, which that's just no going there. The patio.
Right. If you go at 11 a.m. for brunch on a Saturday, guess what? Every table is going to have children at it. Like, just make your peace with that.
Yeah. Yeah. When we joked with Andrew, I think because where we were sitting, we were kind of on, like you said, a corridor that went straight down to the bathroom. It's a straight shot between the bathroom and the outside patio. And we were right on that corridor. If there's an outdoor bathroom, we mentioned this to Andrew too, that he should build an outdoor bathroom. I don't think we would have noticed it at much, you know, and I think the other thing operationally can be challenging having children running around your restaurant. I mean, you've got waiters with very expensive, you know, large plates of food. Kids have a very small footprint.
Yeah, no, that's the one other thing that I wanted to respond to that I keep seeing in social media posts. The restaurant should do something to, you know, the restaurant should manage the children or say something to the parents. It's like, that is not going to happen. No parent wants to be told by some stranger that works at a restaurant how to parent their children. Again, children in an environment where, again, very large playground are going to play and be loud and be children. Yeah. And if expecting the restaurant to step in or try to regulate that is completely unrealistic. If you do not want to be around children, do not go to this restaurant. But if you have children, this is great for you. I mean, this is what you've been wanting, you know, someplace your kids can go and have fun and you can have a really nice steak or pork belly or piece of rainbow trout. Yeah. So, you know, again, I think a lot of this conversation is silly. I think it will mitigate, right? There's a lot of novelty. It's new. It's very crowded. It's drawing a lot of attention. I think a lot of this will go away, but, the bottom line is we had a really good meal there you know, did I love having screaming children run past our table multiple times, like on their way to the bathroom? I did not. Did it detract from the meal? Not really, you know, like it's fine.
And you know, I think that, you know, having that in that area is, you know, why it's in that area, right? This is a family neighborhood. This is, you've got an elementary school less than a mile away. You've got a little league two blocks away. They built this restaurant in this space for a reason. It's wild to me, some of people's takes. And, you know, I've had to find myself not trying to not respond to some of the Facebook comments and just remind myself that, okay, I'm not going to spend time on that. But yeah, I think, you know, family friendly place. And, you know, somebody said on one of the posts, which I thought was I agree with, you know, this kind of shows us that as much as people on these Facebook pages like to complain about kids being in restaurants, like, we do need more of these public spaces that have quality food, right, for families, right? And a weeknight, a weekday, it's a very small window with which kids get out of school at 3 or 4 o'clock. They've got sports or after activities. They're eating between 6 and 8. It's a 2-hour period, right? You know, I think also noting that the proximity of, you know, a lot of these other restaurants that we're talking about, like things like the Stomping Grounds and Diablo, right? Diablo is another one that, you know, people like to complain about. They're in these neighborhoods for a reason. So, you know, no one should really be surprised that there's children at this family-friendly restaurant.
All right, Monica, I'm going to say that does it for the restaurant of the week. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Eric.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Join me on Thursday when my guests will be Brian Doak and Tom Kananen of The Green Room.